You're listening to Talk the Rock with your host, Kayla Darroche, and a few guests with me here today. One of them is a Comfish organizer, and two are people who will be speaking about cannery history at Comfish. So before we get into the nitty-gritty of cannery history, can we talk a little bit about Comfish? And first of all, what is it?
First of all, my name is Julie Bonney, and I am on the Chamber of Commerce Board. I'm the Vice President, and we have a what we call a fish committee that are a bunch of volunteers that help organize Comfish. So this is the 37th year of the Kodiak Comfish of Alaska. It is a commercial fishing trade show hosted by the Kodiak Chamber of Commerce. It is the largest and longest-running commercial fishing trade show in the state, and the only one located in a major Alaska fishing port. And basically, Comfish is usually a three-day event. It starts on March 31 and runs through April 2nd. But this year, because of there's so much interest about what's going on in the fishing industry, we've actually expanded it into March 30th. So we're going to have several special presentations on the 30th of March, which is Wednesday. One is about alternative safety compliance for vessels that are 65 feet in longer, and it's going to be new Coast Guard regulations that start in 2017. So knowing that Kodiak is the largest and most diverse fishing port in the state, we felt it was really important to plug in the commercial fisheries participants into this forum. We also have a seabird bycatch avoidance program that's centered for the longline sector. But in terms, so that's happening the day before, but the other part, and then we're also having a taco feed, fish taco feed, sponsored by the Jig Association here in town and AMC Squared, Alaska Marine Conservation Coalition. So it's, and that's free. It's at the brewery, so it's great tacos for everyone. But then we launch into the main event, which happens on Thursday. And there's two parts that run. One is we have a bunch of vendors. All the vendor slots have been sold out. And so you come and check out the vendors. We have everything to do with boat repair, safety, a lot of the agencies there. And we always have a few new vendors every year. But then we also have, in conjunction with that, a bunch of forums or presentations, which you're going to hear about, one of which is the cannery presentations from the other two guests here. But it's going to be a full event. Some of the notables that I would mention is we're going to have both Senator Sullivan and Senator Murkowski here. Senator Murkowski is going to be talking about what's coming out of Washington, D.C. that affects the Coast Guard base, and then Senator Sullivan's going to be talking about fishery regulations that's coming out of D.C., particularly the Magnuson-Stevens Act reauthorization. Then there's several other events I would note. One is that Trident Seafoods is going to be host. There's a exhibitor refreshment hour that starts at 4 o'clock on Thursday and then also on Friday. And then on Friday, Trident is actually going to open up their kitchen, so to speak, and they're going to be offering appetizers that are end-user products of seafood that they manufacture through their corporation, and that is free. So that's a first-time event. Also, the Elks is doing a fundraiser on Friday night, and there's tickets available for prime rib for a seafood event, but which is $30 each. There's also a breakfast event that's hosted by the Kodiak Rotary Club, and that's from 9 to noon on Saturday, April 2nd. But the panel, you should check out, go to Kodiak Chamber of Commerce, and you can check out all the vendors that are going to be there and also all the different panelists. But we've got people coming from all over to make presentations to the Kodiak community because we are the hub for fishing for certain.
Can you think of any of the vendors that are new this year?
You would ask me that question.
Or anything that comes to your mind, if there are any vendors who stand out at all?
Well, there's R.W. Venstrom, and then we have Satellite Technology Services. We have ASME that's going to be here.
What do these do?
The satellite technology is actually satellite communication. I don't know what R.W. Venstrom is, so I would suggest if you're curious, because you should come down and check out their booth at Comfish.
And I think at the last Comfish, I remember seeing Extra Tufts was there, and possibly some other boot line, which was interesting to me because at that point I had only heard of Extra Tufts as the go-to boot. I was like, this poor fellow.
Well, and actually it was a Belgian company that came in, and they gave boots to all the cannery fillet contestants. Oh, that's something I forgot to mention. So on Saturday, all the processors will be bringing in a pair, a flayer and a trimmer, and the sector will be competing for the best fillet trimmer team, and then they've also added a harvester competition in the afternoon. So the different harvesters will be doing knot tying and web mending and stuff like that and demonstrating their skills. So that's a new event on Saturday. You're on that committee. Go, Toby.
Well, flaying is definitely something I like to watch people doing because it seems like such a skill. And it's hard to practice, right? Because what are you going to practice on? Something you're going to eat. So every time you practice and you do it wrong, it's like, oops, yeah, this is my practice go. Like 50 bad fish later, you finally got that filleting thing done.
And it's good to watch because they do both round fish and flat fish, which is a totally different technique. And
really?
There's been some suggestions of there's a western cut and an eastern cut, and most folks don't understand the difference, so actually have a demonstration of some of the different cuts before we get into the actual competition.
What is the difference?
It's the way the collar area is cut, I guess, is the best way to explain it.
We'll have to see to see the difference. You'll have to go.
And we're going to have door prizes. So if you're there, then they'll be, and you're in the audience watching, you might get a chance to win something. So.
And there's also one of the talks will be about cannery history, or two of the talks, really, because we have two people here, and there are two separate talks that you're both doing, right, Toby?
Well, this is Anjali, actually. Sorry, Toby. Anjali Grantham. We are part of the same forum, so there are different sessions throughout Comfish on different topics, and we are part of the Kodiak Cannery History Forum this year. So we're coming together to talk about the history of different canneries around Kodiak and the seafood industry.
And I'm sure that, especially if you're a KMXT listener, that you have seen the evidence of cannery history popping up around town in the decorative new trash cans we have. And also, Anjali has been producing some really interesting history snippets, audio snippets about some of the people involved in cannery history. And she can talk about that in a second. But, Toby, what's your talk about?
Well, I think we talked about different subjects, but I did a talk a couple of weeks ago at the Baranoff about a couple of murders of a cannery union workers in Seattle in 1981, and the response was pretty positive to the talk, and a lot of people wondered about it and weren't able to go, so I'm going to give the talk again at Comfish. So it concerns Filipino cannery workers who were working for cannery worker rights and Filipino rights in the cannery industry in the 70s, and they were murdered in Seattle in 1981 by henchmen hired by Ferdinand Marcos, the president of the Philippines. It's quite an amazing story. So I'll be talking about that again.
Yeah, I remember when we were talking about that, we met earlier. It was surprised me to learn that the people who wanted to assassinate these two activists, they were from various parties. They were from the gang scene down in the Lower 48 and also from the Philippines. How did that work?
Well, it's a kind of a complicated situation, but the Filipino cannery workers had been unionized for about 80 years at that point in the 1980s, and the cannery union helped hire and get people into the canneries, into the salmon industry in Alaska. The cannery union in Seattle at that time was fairly corrupt. It was run by a corrupt union boss who named Tony Baracco, and he was more interested in money and corruption than he was in cannery worker rights. And there was a new generation of Filipino cannery workers coming up in the 70s, and they were interested in civil rights because there was definitely some civil rights issues in the salmon industry in those days. So there was a conflict between the people who actually ran the union and these young Turks who were coming up. And that conflict played out in a very violent way in the end. And it's central to the story of the Kodiak, or to the Alaska salmon industry, because it was such an important part of how the industry was run. It used originally Chinese labor and then Filipino labor in a lot of these canneries. So by the 70s, a lot of issues were coming to the fore, and there was tension within the union and tension against the canneries. So it's really an amazing era, an amazing story. And the other part of it is that Ferdinand Marcos was involved because these two guys, Gene Viernes and a guy named Silme, they had gone to the Philippines to organize labor unions in the Philippines in the late 70s, and Ferdinand Marcos didn't like that. So he was part of the money that actually was used to hire the killers that killed these two gentlemen in Seattle.
What were some of the existing policies that existed in the canneries prior to the 1970s and that some of that revolution of policy?
Well, the canneries had started, of course, in California in the 1860s, and then on the Sacramento River for salmon, and then eventually in Astoria on the Columbia River, and by the 1870s and 80s were in Alaska. They used Chinese labor. There were hundreds of thousands of Chinese who had come over from China for the gold rush and then afterwards, and they called America the Gold Mountain because there was all this work. And they ended up being the labor force for the salmon industry. The capital came from bankers in New York and San Francisco, and the labor came from Chinese. The Chinese were starting to be excluded by the 1890s. There was actually the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which forbid any more Chinese to emigrate to the United States. And as they aged out of the workforce, the Filipinos, who were absorbed into the United States hegemony in the 1898 Spanish-American War, suddenly there were all these Filipino people who were available as a labor force. And they started coming into the industry around 1900 and eventually dominated the labor force. The issue at hand was that these, in the olden days, the housing and jobs and pay were all segregated based on race. It was originally the Chinese. No one questioned this at the time. And then it was the Filipinos. And by the 1970s, they still had segregated housing, segregated dining halls, and certain jobs were not available to Filipinos. And by the 1960s and 70s, this was untenable. And Filipino people were starting to ask questions about that and to rebel against that. And these two cannery workers in 1981 were fighting that system. And they were already part of a lawsuit, which ended up in the Supreme Court, which tried to change those outstanding, or I would say, issues that had been around for a long time and were just accepted. But by then, their time had passed.
How did the murders affect that legislation and its reception?
The legislation was well on its way by that time, but it didn't really... It was actually a lawsuit against the canneries that these gentlemen were part of, along with a lot of other people. And the lawsuit went all the way to the Supreme Court by the 1980s, and the Supreme Court didn't really deal with it very well. So Congress stepped in and wrote a new Civil Rights Act in 1992, which dealt with these issues. So these guys were killed before any of that came to fruition. They were part of the process on the way to those final steps.
And it sounds like the Filipino population kind of dominated the cannery scene for a long time. How long did that last?
Well, I think the Filipinos started coming into the industry before 1900 and are still a major force in the cannery industry and the processing industry today, as we see in this community.
Mm-hmm. And
one thing, too, that you didn't mention, Toby, that is the real Kodiak connection is the fact that Silme Domingo and Gene Viernes worked at the Uganek cannery.
Well, Silme did.
Oh, okay, just Silme. Okay.
Yeah. Gene worked at Naknek, and then he worked in Southeast. But Silme, yeah, he worked at the Uganek cannery, and at that time, the Uganek cannery was run by the New England Fish Company, and they were sued in a class action suit by all these cannery workers, as several other canneries were. So Silmay worked there. His father had worked there before him. And that was really the story of this, is that the Filipino cannery workers were a multi-generational workforce. Sons followed fathers into the industry who had followed their fathers. And it was very much of a community and a family enterprise in some ways. So when Silmay was working at the cannery, he actually told friends that he saw his father's initials carved into the side of a bunkhouse, and his father had worked there in the 1940s.
Wow. Where were canneries located on Kodiak Island? What were some of the big ones?
They were located everywhere around the island, and there are remnants everywhere around the island still. Some of the places are now, more than anything, archaeological sites. But where you see nubby pilings, there was once a cannery or a saltery. We have this Kroll map that shows canneries around Alaska for just 1 year of operation. I think it's is it 40 or 47 or something like that?
Yeah, those maps were updated every few years. So mm-hmm. I think the one we have is a 1948
yeah.
version.
And I counted the number of canneries that were represented around Alaska for just on that map. And there were over 140 canneries were in operation just that 1 year. So when you consider the number that were in operation around Alaska from the first cannery, 1878, to the present day, there's been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of canneries that have operated around Alaska. And in Kodiak, there's been dozens easily. The only two that are still in operation that are off the road system are Alitak and Larsen Bay. But some are now being used as lodges. For example, the Zacher Bay Cannery. A couple of years ago, we hosted this forum for Comfish as well, and Linda Eaton presented on the Zacher Bay Lodge, which is a former cannery, and she talked about the history of that place. It's really interesting. Also, Parks Cannery in Uyak is a lodge now. I think it's called Spirit of Alaska Lodge. And some others as well, like Port Bailey. So some of these old canneries still have life in them. They're not being used to process fish, but they're homes and used for fishing still, actually, but sports fishing. But there have been dozens of fish processing sites located around Kodiak. I mean, on the Karlik Spit alone, there were at least a dozen. And now there's nothing left there except ruins of buildings. And within Uganic Bay, there were a couple. It's just really any place. You had to be close to the fishing grounds back then. Everything has changed, technologically speaking, with refrigeration. Before, you really had to be close to the fishing grounds to be able to process fish, because you didn't have time to bring the fish far away in order to have them canned. And so now, though, with refrigerated seawater and other technological innovations, you're able to travel long distances with fish before they're processed. And so that really changed the geography of the placement of processing sites around Alaska.
Yeah, and maybe we should back up a little and focus on the project that you've been working on, the Cannery Project. Could you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, the Alaska Historic Canneries Initiative is an initiative of the Alaska Historical Society, and it's really a grassroots project to do more to recognize and document and preserve the history of the seafood industry around Alaska. So I spoke with you a couple weeks ago about the grant program that we launched, and we've awarded small grants to individuals and organizations around the state to for them to do small cannery history projects. We're doing educational presentations all around the state. Toby and I shared a booth at the Pacific Marine Expo in Seattle this year. We presented there. Recently, we were talking about it at Fisher Poets in Astoria. And I am really excited. I'm traveling to Craig next week to go and talk at their Whale Fest about cannery history. So there's presentations that are happening around the state. We're encouraging projects like the Trash Can Project here in Kodiak, for example, that Bruce Schockler spearheaded. They're doing a similar one in Petersburg right now, and they're unveiling their trash cans next week. And they're putting information together in panels for a small cannery history park within Petersburg. So there's projects that are taking place all over, and we're just trying to keep the momentum, spread the word that history is really important to the industry. The economics and the biological study of the industry is really what gets all of the attention. And we're hoping to make it so that it's a more inclusive conversation, and history and culture are also recognized as being critical to the commercial fishing industry.
Yeah, and I've been seeing the decorative trash cans around town, and they add a little fishing history decoration to storefronts, and they're really cool, and you can kind of feel a little bit of the history coming through in our trash cans now, and I really am excited about that. And I think the one at Cost Savers has like a little watchman on it.
Yeah.
For the Watchman brand. And
yep, there's some really beautiful ones, the Butterfly brand, the Poinsettia brand, and a lot of them are from the Alaska Packers Association, which was a huge, huge business, one of the most important businesses in the history of Alaska. And it was founded on the Karluk Spit back in 1891. So that's a direct tie to the history of Kodiak. When you see Alaska Packers Association brand, think of our local fishing industry.
And I think one of the organizers mentioned that there will be a part two of the project.
Yeah, we're hoping to, we're working to put together information to make some panels that will talk about the history of the salmon industry. So it'll include information on the labels and the different companies that are represented on the labels. We'd love to be able to show the map, which is on top of the cans, kind of expand on that and talk about the locations of canneries around the island. And talk about the people that historically have been involved in the processing industry.
And I'm also just curious to learn about how both of you developed this interest in this aspect of fishing industry.
Well, I'm the executive director of the Kodiak Maritime Museum, which has been around since 1992. And the Kodiak Maritime Museum was begun by people who realized that there was this huge history of maritime Alaska that was not being addressed by anybody in the state. So the museum has been working on trying to bring that history to the people of Kodiak for a number of years. But the cannery initiative actually in some ways began when there was a big plant in Kenai called the Kenai Packers Association. And it was accessible by road, which is a rarity for big wooden salmon canneries. And it was sold in the late 90s and in the early 2000s. It stopped operating. And various businesses tried to take it over and turn it into a lodge and a gift shop and various things like that. And eventually they all failed. And they tore the building down. And it was the last major cannery on the road system of Alaska where people could actually drive and see it. And at that point, I think it got a lot of people's attention, especially in Anchorage and in the historical community. And at that point, there was letters written to the editor, and there was a big discussion started, and the Alaska Historical Society started to address that. And Angeli's initiative is definitely comes out of that. But locally, the Maritime Museum has been looking at and addressing these issues for a number of years. And the Thelma Sea exhibit, which we're hard at work on, actually the boat itself is an artifact of the salmon industry, and the interpretive panels that will be around the boat will tell the story of the local salmon industry, which, as Angeli has said, is basically where it started in western Alaska, was at the Karluk Spit. And so we're all kind of on the same page on this. What's really interesting is that for a long time, people just caught salmon and didn't think about the historical aspects of it. And now I have conversations in the harbor almost every day when I go down to my office. I run into guys that I fished with in the olden days, and I go, dude, you're part of history now. And it's kind of a funny thing, but it's very, very true. And having had this job for the last few years in the wintertime, I'll think of things that we're doing that are now current in the fishing industry, thinking about them in historical terms. I mean, IFQs was a very hot-button issue here for a number of years. And it is part of Alaska's history. It really is. So there's things like that that are going on now that seem current, and you don't think of them in the long pages of history, but they really are part of a longer fabric.
How did you develop the interest in this?
Well, I just come from a Kodiak fishing family, and I spent my summers when I was a kid beach seining in Uganic Bay at a place called Packer Spit, and I love to play with the old pile of bricks that were in the middle of a grassy field, and I always heard that there was a cannery there, but I grew up and I was always fascinated with Kodiak's history, and I did some research and uncovered that it was named for the Alaska Packers Association, and I remember going to the Uganic Cannery when I was a kid, and I just loved to walk on the boardwalks and see the old buildings, because the fact of the matter is that even though Kodiak is the oldest Western settlement in the Pacific coast north of San Francisco, there's no way that you would know that walking around town. So my first experience in a historic neighborhood was a Uganic cannery, and I loved the feel of it. And so I've just always had an affinity for historic places, and canneries are some of the most historic places in Alaska. So I think that's really what drew me to it. Plus, I'm from Kodiak, and so I mean, no need to justify that it's an important industry here, you know. So, talking about the forum a bit, I'll be presenting about the initiative, but also talking about canneries on the west side of Kodiak Island this summer. Brianna Peterson and I, when we were doing the West Side Stories project, had the opportunity to visit a lot of the old canneries, and so I'm going to be talking about how the canneries are used today in old cannery sites. And also, Megan Cormetis is going to be presenting on the history of the Mosier Bay Cannery on the south end of the island, so it'll be great to get some south end history in there, too.
All right. Well, you've been listening to Talk of the Rock, and we've been listening to some people who'll be speaking at Comfish coming up, which is on what date again?
March 31 through April 2nd.
All right. So keep tuned for more information on that, and check out the Chamber of Commerce website, right?
Exactly.
All right. Thank you guys for listening. You've been listening to Talk of the Rock with your host, Kayla Darosh, and Toby, Angeli, and...
Julie Bonney.
Julie Bonney.
Thank you.
Thank you.